Hi, it's Bill Radke. You know, it's Pledge Week here at KUOW. Now, for this podcast, we cut out all the Pledge Drive stuff we did and just gave you pure Week in Review gold. But this show and all of KUOW do rely on you. So please, go from being a listener to a booster. Pledge online right now at KUOW.org. And thank you.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Want to know
because you like your sky drone free, or maybe you want your Amazon package airmailed. I'm Bill Radke. This week, Amazon asked the FAA for permission to test drones outside. How do you feel about packages flying over your head? We asked you that and more on Facebook, and I'll share your answers in a few minutes. Join the chat on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. We are live tweeting the show this hour, as always, at KUOW. Or right after you call in your pledge, keep the phone in your hand and dial 206-685-2526 and leave us a message. It's 685-BLAM. This is KUOW's Week in Review, and thank you for making it possible. Joni Balter hosts Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Knute Berger is Crosscut.com's Mossback, and Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. Hey, team.
Hey,
good morning.
Welcome. Thanks for coming in to review the news. Let's start with Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella, who says he was wrong when he said yesterday that women don't need to ask for a raise because they should have faith that the system will reward them. Nadella was on stage at the Grace Hopper Celebration of Women in Computing in Phoenix, and he answered a question about advice for women who don't feel comfortable asking for a raise.
It's not really about asking for the raise, but knowing and having faith that the system will actually give you the right raises as you go along. And that, I think, might be one of the additional superpowers that, quite frankly, women who don't ask for a raise have. Because that's good karma. It'll come back. Because somebody's going to know that's the kind of person that I want to trust. That's the kind of person that I want to really give more responsibility to. And in the long-term efficiency, things catch up. And I'm not saying that that's the only approach.
He said your best work will get rewarded in the long term. First of all, is that true, woman correspondent Joni Balter?
Speaking for all women.
Of course.
As you know, you have to do sometimes. This is, of course, reflective of a problem in the tech industry. The tech industry, you know, this isn't a secret. Everybody knows these guys have a hard time, A, hiring women, B, paying women. And so far, and I haven't waited until the next world kind of thing, that the raises don't follow based on karma. You kind of do lean in. Oh my gosh, you have to ask.
Yeah. He said that on Twitter, he said soon afterward that I was inarticulate regarding how women should ask for a raise. And then in an email to Microsoft employees last night, he said, I answered that question completely wrong. I believe men and women should get equal pay for equal work. And when it comes to career advice on getting a raise when you think it's deserved, the advice was the right advice. If you think you deserve a raise, you should just ask. Eli, is that an apology?
No, it's backpedaling, it's damage control, it's maybe eating some crow, but I didn't hear the words, I'm sorry. And it would have been a good moment for him to remind people and maybe himself that Microsoft is 71% male in terms of its workforce, and study after study shows a huge pay gap between men and women, particularly in the tech world. So that's not a situation where the data suggests that just sitting back and waiting for karma to come around and give you more money is going to work. You do need to ask.
By the way, while he said that it was had to do with karma, there was a smile in his voice. How seriously should we take his comments, Knute?
Well, the implications of it are pretty astounding. I mean, one is that anybody who's underpaid has bad karma. And apparently Steve Ballmer has great karma.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, you know, and it's interesting, too, because the whole concept of karma, I mean, we've sort of secularized it, but it's really a religious term. And if he had, in fact, said, well, God will take care of you, just, you know, work hard and somebody will recognize, you know, the Lord will recognize. It's ridiculous. It really, and it's astonishing. This isn't a matter of inarticulateness. It's cluelessness.
Isn't he just saying what every CEO tells you? If you work for less, you'll be rewarded? Newsflash, your boss wants you to work cheap.
Yes, but you don't say it in a conference that, as I understand it, is designed on helping women get ahead in the workplace.
Right.
And you shouldn't think it to begin with.
Are female Microsoft employees about to get a nice raise out of this courtesy of the PR department?
One would hope. One would expect. And we'll have to, it'll be quiet, though. It's not like you're going to get some announcement. You're just going to hear a little cheer at some of those desks.
Well, I think one of the things was a lot of people seem to resent the email that he sent out because it was sort of like, oh, well, I give you permission now to go to your manager and ask for a raise, instead of saying something like, I'm beginning an internal task force that will resolve the issue of pay disparity at Microsoft. In other words, it's a very kind of, you know, throw it back in your lap kind of thing.
So they should have like the line for the flu shots and then the line for the raises kind of like merging in the halls of Microsoft.
On our Facebook page, Wendy said, the reason why women are uncomfortable asking for raises isn't because we are shy or we don't believe that we deserve them. It is because the systemic issues surrounding equal pay also play into how women who ask for more money are perceived and thus treated, parentheses, punished in the workplace. Do you think that's still true?
Yes, of course. The women have to, you know, there's just this imbalance, and especially in the tech business, there's a huge imbalance. And I think that maybe the best thing that can come from this will be, you know, all joshing aside, that any woman at Microsoft or maybe some of the other tech companies who comes forward and says, you know, I got this feeling that it wasn't really being treated seriously, will now be treated more seriously.
My last question, do you think there is any long-term fallout for Satya Nadella from this, or do we forget this soon enough?
Long-term fallout, that's really hard to say. I'm sure it's going to be based on his overall performance, but I think it certainly helps we're still getting to know him, the public is, and this isn't going to help his brand.
Yes,
Microsoft is a very data-focused company. I would say that people should not forget and look at actions and results rather than words, really, in the long run. Can he change the percentage of employees at Microsoft that are female, and how are they doing relative to men in terms of pay?
I'll give the last word to Katie on our Facebook page. She says, not my quote, but one I saw yesterday, because I totally got to be CEO by sitting quietly and trusting in the system, said no CEO ever. This is KUOW's Week in Review, back in a moment. By the way, this morning I went to the Microsoft store and shoplifted a Surface tablet because I know that Microsoft will get that money back in the long term.
But now your karma's taken a hit.
Oh, rats. KUOW's Week in Review with Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, Knute Berger. Good morning. I'm Bill Radke. Your boss tells you you have to do something after work. When you do that thing, are you working? Whose time is it? That question hit the U.S. Supreme Court this week with former Amazon warehouse workers arguing they should have been paid for the time they spent waiting in security lines after their shifts. Joni, will you lay out what the argument is?
Yes. So before the Supreme Court is this case by former Amazon warehouse workers, generally working at the Nevada fulfillment centers. And the gist of it is when they would end a shift, they would have to go, think of like a reverse security line. Instead of going into a building, it's reverse security coming out. So as you go out, you stand in the line and they make sure that since you were dealing with products that you didn't put something in your pocket or your bag.
They call that shrinkage.
They call that a lot of shrinkage. But what the idea is that if you went through this really quickly, I don't think we'd have an issue here, but they had a backup. They didn't have an incentive, the workers argue. They didn't have an incentive to make that line shorter, so it would take up to like a half an hour. So these workers are arguing, and there's some very hazy precedent on all of this. These workers are arguing that they should be paid for that time because it took so long. They had to be on the premises. It's not like they could go out and, you know, start living the rest of the day. So in the way this has gone for a long time, do you think folks... Do you, Mr. Radke, think that you should be paid for getting to work?
No.
The answer will be no.
But the thing is, I could sleep outside the office if I wanted to. They're not ordering me to commute, but they are ordering these employees to stand in that line.
Right. So that's why this is hazy. So the courts over time have ruled, it depends on what the situation is, to get a security clearance for the airport. Since everyone does it, not so much. But to remove protective clothing, say from a car battery plant, that was counted as something you absolutely had to get all that stuff off of you. And so that was counted as time that you should be paid. So it's hazy precedent, but you know, a lot of people have these issues with their work. That's why it's such a fascinating story. This is worth a zillion dollars, this case, if you think about all the companies that sort of require you to do something extra, but they're not paying you for it. And then I, in my mind, and this didn't come up, I think it has to be weighed against how much Facebook time you spend on their time, how much time you're talking to the family. You know, I mean, so this is quite dicey and quite a fascinating case.
Yeah, it's hazy. Knut, can you pierce the haze?
Not really. I mean, it's interesting to think about where those lines are. I mean, one of the complaints in this case is that the contractor that Amazon used to do the security checks had no requirement of doing it in a way that would be timely for the employees. So these people are waiting like an extra half hour after they've clocked out in this kind of no man's land. And, you know, I think the points of law are often very fine in terms of like whose power are you under at that moment. When you're traveling to work, you're under your own authority. You're controlling your own actions. When you're leaving work, that's not exactly the same. Yeah, especially when you're still in the building, when you're still in, you know, on the premises and that kind of. I thought it was also interesting that the Obama administration is kind of taking Amazon's side in the legal case.
Now, Amazon says it has reduced the amount of time it takes, but would they have reduced that amount of time if the workers hadn't made a federal case out of it?
That's a good question. And this law, as I understand it, that's at the heart of this, was originally a worker protection law. So it seems like the question is the Supreme Court going to put its thumb on the scales for protecting workers, or the company right now is trying to protect itself from workers by wasting the workers' time, really? But the question is, for me, I mean, there's no piercing the haze here, but if you can pierce through the core question, who is the law for? Who does the law protect, workers or the company?
Yeah. Well, if Amazon loses, it'll have to find a way to reduce the time it takes for workers to be delivered from one place to another. Do you think Amazon could get efficient at doing things like that? Who knows? Meanwhile, speaking of Amazon, the company is tired of its drivers having to sit in lines, traffic lines. So they want to deliver your packages with aerial drones. And this week, they asked the FAA for permission to test drones outdoors, as correspondent Tom Bonsi told us.
Amazon's legal department assured the FAA that the testing can be done safely. Small battery-powered drones would fly no higher than 400 feet off the ground, remain within line of sight of the operator, and have a kill switch if something goes wrong.
Again, on our Facebook page, Nicole asked a good question. Wouldn't this require hundreds or thousands of drones in the sky to make it ultimately worth Amazon's while? Eli, how many drones does Amazon envision? Do we have any idea?
They haven't put a number on it, but they've said one day drones in the sky delivering packages will be as common as seeing mail trucks or maybe UPS trucks on the road. So that many, a lot.
So are you disturbed by the prospect?
Well, here's what I'm amazed at. The Amazon is talking about, you know, drones that'll fly for 30 minutes, that'll go 50 miles an hour, that'll carry 5 pounds, which is the average package weight. And of 80%, or I'm sorry, that's the weight of 86% of the products that Amazon delivers. So 5 pound objects flying in the grip of objects that weigh some other number of pounds, 400 feet above a busy city, what could possibly go wrong? And what I'm amazed at is the outrage and furor that erupted when the Seattle Police Department wanted to do the exact same thing. They just wanted to test drones in Discovery Park and I think some other parks. And people in the city flipped out. This company wants to do it, and there's a different reaction. Now, I think a lot of the police concerns were related to surveillance and so on, but they were also related to safety, to drones falling out of the sky, to whether the drones can actually be controlled and piloted well, whether you can fly them in the rain and the wind. And all of these questions apply to Amazon drones and to a future where potentially we have these things zipping around above us all the time.
Well, what about Kim's point on Facebook, who says, I say yes, smaller fossil fuel footprint, easier to get to outlying areas, foot in the door to personal air travel. Let's go for it.
You know, when I first heard this story, like a lot of other folks, when it was on 60 Minutes, I thought, this is so far-fetched. It's a PR stunt. It will not happen. Ha, ha, ha. But then as the months have gone by, it's starting to feel a little inevitable to me. It doesn't mean I like it, but it just is starting to feel a little inevitable because, for example, the FAA did allow some cinematographers access to the airspace, shall we say. So once you let one group in, do you really think Amazon's going to sit there quietly? That is their style, as we all know, or not.
Right.
Well, I have a divided thing on this, which is I hate the idea of the Amazon drone delivery just for the reasons that Eli was talking about. But I think they ought to be allowed to test the technology. I think from a, you know, we're an aerospace state. I mean, from a technological standpoint, if they want to put money into R&D, I think they ought to be allowed to do testing as long as it's under safe conditions. I just hope the tests will reveal that it's a dumb idea.
Yeah, that is. You're right. That's what they're asking for, is permission to even check it out in some place outside Seattle, and I don't know where that place is.
They haven't said, but it is their own private property. Now, the FAA has licensed or authorized all these test sites around the country to test drones for commercial purposes, and Washington had applied. Boeing was behind the application. We didn't get the test site. Other states have, and Amazon has said, well, it'll go and do some testing in those authorized test sites, but actually it has a lot of money and can buy a huge amount of property outside of Seattle, so could we please just build our own private test site and test drones there?
Again, I'll give the last word to our Facebook writers. Jennifer says, how fast will it be until someone realizes if they can take the drone down, they'd get free stuff? So that's the pinata point of view on it. And finally, the headline was, Amazon asks FAA for permission to test aerial delivery drones near Seattle. And Bill wrote, Seattle residents ask FAA to test shotgun firing at targets flying under 100 feet over private property. This is KUOW's Week in Review. We'll be right back. On KUOW's Week in Review, Crosscut's Knute Berger, Joni Balter from the Seattle Channel, host of Civic Cocktail, and the Strangers, Eli Sanders, telling you that karma alone is not going to power this radio station.
That's right.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Bill Radke. So recapping the news of the week, this week Seattle proclaimed Monday Indigenous Peoples Day, even though Monday is already Columbus Day. This angered some local Italian Americans, including Ralph Fasciatelli, who says this is not over. City council members will have to run for re-election next year.
There are four times as many Seattle Italian Americans in this city than Native Americans. We've got a lot of deep-pocketed, successful business people that have underwritten a very expensive ad in the Seattle Times and launched a full-fledged pushback on this. We're taking a stand. We've taken these barbs over the last 50 years that were all part of organized crime, and frankly, we're tired of it.
So it's not over. Knute, will the Seattle City Council elections hinge on the Italian issue?
I doubt it. I don't know if there's still a concentration of Italians anywhere as there used to be in South Seattle, so-called Garlic Gulch,
where you grew up.
But it's interesting to me that Columbus Day is a national holiday. It hasn't been a state holiday or city holiday in some time, and I think that. There are a lot of ethnic groups that are fairly sizable in the city that don't celebrate national, don't have their special day in the way. And I also think it's not a slap at the Italian community. It's really an attempt to do something for the Native American community. And I think anybody who knows anything about our history here knows that's a very special history.
But the coincidence of dates, like there could have been a different date chosen.
No, but I think part of it is that it raises a discussion that needs to happen. And that's what I really agreed with Bruce Harrell when he said that if this city wants to do all that it can do in terms of its social services, education, outreach, and be the vibrant city it wants to be, it has to come to terms with some of the negative things in its past. And this raises the discussion so that that can be part of it now.
It's not a coincidence of dates. I mean, there's a very intentional combining of the dates,
right,
in order to put forward a critique of what happened to Native Americans and indigenous people in the Americas after Columbus discovered, quote-unquote, discovered the country, which was not a country yet.
A place, and he never went there.
Right.
And he didn't know where he was.
Right.
And he went about enslaving
right.
people.
It's amazing to me that this has become a zero-sum game. I mean, the people who are taking offense and promising to take down Chama Sawant maybe in the next elections are absorbing this as if the entire critique and blame for everything that happened after Columbus, quote unquote, discovered America has been put on his shoulders because of this day. I don't think anyone who knows history would say Columbus alone is responsible for all of the deaths of Native Americans that came afterward, but he was a part of a period in history that was very dark for a lot of indigenous people. He had a hand in it. And so that, as I absorb it, is the critique. Why can't that coexist with Columbus Day? I fail to understand that.
Well, here's how you coexist it, just to see if I can make that work. You separate the days. This is a symbolic act by the city council. By the way, Stephen Colbert made massive fun of us about this. But this is a symbolic act. And if you're going to do things about symbolism, why do you have to alienate another group that clearly feels alienated by doing this? So to me, it's so reflexively PC, over the top, unnecessary. They could have picked any other day, and they probably should have done that. It seems to me the city council stepped in it this time.
I think their sense of alienation and umbrage is honestly a little obtuse. I mean, it's not, it is not, like I said, saying that that Columbus didn't exist, that he didn't do what he did, that he didn't, you know, play some hand in exploring. And it's not blaming him, as I understand it, for every single thing that ever happened afterward. But it is saying that he was, like I said, part of a period that had really adverse consequences.
But it's pretty interesting now that this group didn't just meet to say, hi, we're offended, and we told the city council we're offended, but that they actually want to raise money and sort of use it in the district elections that are coming up against various city council members. I spoke to Nick Licata because he's under double pressure because he's Italian, and I.
Yeah, an Italian American critic of the new Indigenous Peoples Day came on this show live and said that Nick Licata is a bad Italian.
And so I asked Nick, "Are you a bad Italian?" And we went through a little quick drill there. Do you speak Italian? No, his family wanted to assimilate, so they didn't focus on the language. Can you make cannoli? I asked him, and he said, not so much. If he had a recipe, no, that's a no, sorry. But he did point out in his own defense here that in his first campaign, I don't remember what year that was, but in his first campaign, he had the Licata frittata recipe on his campaign literature. So he wants to, he definitely, even though he maybe just dissed the Italians that are of his heritage, he just wants to remind you that he ran on that at one point.
There's your campaign slogan. Right there. I brought you the Licata frittata. And I always will. Speaking of indigenousness, did anyone else notice what happened this week, the same week that the Seahawks played the Washington Redskins?
I'm still part red man deep inside.
Part red man deep inside. This was the number one song in July 1971.
Cherokee people, Cherokee tribe.
This is a Northwest band. You're nodding your head, Canute. Paul Revere and the Raiders. You're also laughing. And they dressed in Revolutionary War costumes that made them look silly. But when the band leader died this week, I found out what I didn't know. That was his real name, Paul Revere Dick. He was from Boise. He played the keyboard. Singer was from Eugene. They recorded Louie Louie in Portland. And in 1971, I'm 6 years old listening to Donny Osmond sing Go Away, Little Girl. And all of a sudden,
they took the whole Cherokee Nation, put us on this reservation.
You're still laughing, Canute. Now, this may not have been the best message song ever, but it was the first message song I ever heard as a kid. I stopped the game I was playing of Cowboys and Indians and said, like, Dad, what is this song about? Who were the bad guys? Paul Revere was not a soldier. He was a Mennonite, a conscientious objector to the Vietnam War who did his military service as a cook at a mental institution in Wilsonville, Oregon. And so I never forgot the moment I heard that song, and never forgot that your school might not give you the whole story and that a song could be the truest thing you hear all day. So I say farewell to Paul Revere Dick, who died in Idaho this week at age 76.
Cherokee Nation will return. We'll return, we'll return, we'll return.
KUOW's Week in Review will return in a moment. Good morning. Sitting with the smart people, I'm Bill Radke. That's Eli Sanders, Knute Berger, and Joni Balter. Well, my neighbors on Mercer Island can once again drink the water. The water tested clean of E. coli. No more boiling, and it means I don't have to hear the jokes. Hey, that's what you get for rolling in money. That stuff's not sanitary. Of course you can't find the E. coli. Your waste doesn't stink, which makes detection more difficult. Waste stinks for a reason. Not funny, okay? So, glad to hear that news. Let's talk about some other water, specifically the ports of Seattle and Tacoma, which are now saying they're going to cooperate, not merge, but they will manage their cargo businesses jointly. Canute, why should our listeners care?
Well, it's a huge deal. I mean, the Port of Seattle and the Port of Tacoma have competed for years. I mean, the whole reason Tacoma and Seattle are where they are was because they were port cities, and we were competing port cities, and we have been that way since the very beginning. Sometimes Tacoma was ahead, sometimes we were ahead, and it's still in our DNA. There's a kind of competitiveness
By the way, you may have Tacoma listeners right now who don't consider us Seattle we.
Well, that's true.
Go on.
Anyway, the competitiveness runs deep. It's still, when the Russell Company left Tacoma and came to Seattle, they were mad. We were happy.
Yep.
But the port business is under tremendous challenge. I mean, the Panama Canal is being widened. It's going to change where cargo flows.
They don't have to stop at the West Coast if they can go around.
They can go all the way around. You've got issues that have to do with the fact that the Canadians and British Columbia are beefing up their port facilities, beefing up their rail capacity. They're doing everything they can to be the dominant Pacific port on the West Coast. And I think there was a recognition that if we don't hang together, we'll hang separately, is the old phrase, that Seattle and Tacoma are kind of bearing the hatchet in terms of managing the ports. And this isn't the airport. This isn't the tourist stuff and the cruise ships. This is specifically port
cargo
coming in and out. And it's really a kind of unprecedented alliance. And I think it's an alliance many people have felt for a long time should happen.
Is there no downside and no risk?
Well, there is a downside because we don't really know the details of how it's going to work. So one of the issues would be it won't really save any money, but will cooperating create a different kind of warfare between the two groups? In other words, can they really get along is one of the issues. But I think by combining the effort, they also have more clout, I think, when it comes to dealing with Olympia on a unified basis, because the state transportation plan that we've been promised over and over again is...
Aha, state transportation plan.
Is crucial to both Seattle and Tacoma. This might give them a joint strategy for how to get that transportation plan passed, a lot of which has to do with freight mobility.
I have a question about how all this plays out, and it wasn't explained as far as I could tell in the articles about this. We elect the port commissioners in Seattle, and Tacoma elects its port commissioners. And so these are bodies, theoretically, that are supposed to represent these two kind of areas that may not have coincident interests all the time. So will that torpedo the cooperation impulse after a while if something that Seattle voters think is in their favor is not really in the interest of cooperation between Seattle and Tacoma from the commissioner's point of view? And then two, are there an equal number of commissioners in Seattle and Tacoma on the board, and how are they? Do they form a combined board?
As far as I know, I mean, they can't change the government structure by an agreement. They'd have. I mean, these are
back out
districts, so they're gonna have like a common manager of that business, and they're entering a phase now between now and I think March where they're gonna work out the details. And in those details, there's all kinds of ways things could go wrong. But they say they're going to have public meetings. The port commissions are going to stay in place.
I guess one thing they have going for them is no one pays attention to poor commission races anyway. For the most part.
But the truth is here that this didn't come about until it was advantageous to both sides. So in a cup, and I don't necessarily have the right year here, but in a recent year, Tacoma's business was going up, Seattle's was going down. Oops, why are we fighting each other? We should be competing with Prince Rupert instead of one another. So there's a sense on all among most of them, if not all of them, that this works better for everybody. And it didn't happen until that was the driving force.
Could you imagine someday, would Seattle ever just send the cargo part of its business to Tacoma and just focus on shopping and cruises and stadiums and condos?
Well, I think that's pretty easy to imagine that could happen. I think one of the problems they were getting into was fighting amongst each other and trying to underbid each other for port business. And that was ending up not being to anybody's benefit. I think the market, to some degree, is going to decide that issue. Who's got the right facilities, who, you know, where the timing is right, because Seattle is a little closer to the Pacific than Tacoma is.
Yeah, it's a little farther to go to get to Tacoma, so there has to be an advantage to get there.
KUOW's Week in Review with Joni Balter and Knute Berger and Eli Sanders, all, of course, thanks to you. Joni Balter, Eli Sanders, Knute Berger, and Bill Radke are part of a Week in Review, but you really need Luke Burbank to make the whole thing sing. Lucas, welcome.
Hello there.
Luke Burbank from LiveWire tonight and also from the podcast TBTL. What's been on your mind this week, brother?
Well, there's been some controversy down there at 23rd and Union.
Yes.
And it revolves around a church that is not happy that the Ike's Pot Shop is going in right down the street. In fact, kind of right next door, I think. I was looking at this, by the way, on Google Maps today, the street view. This is how I monitor things in Seattle now that I'm in the small maritime village of Port Townsend.
Mm-hmm.
And am I right to assume that the actual location, because it's listed at 23rd and Madison, is it going in where the cheesesteak place was?
It's right behind that. The cheesesteak place is going to become, you know, in a very circle of life sort of way, a glass bong and whatever.
Oh,
makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
And the church is right next door to this parking lot.
Basically, they're creating the low motivation district. You can get your weed, you can get your glass bong, you can just do it all right there. Well, isn't also the Neighbor Lady, a bar that I very much enjoy frequenting, also next door to that?
Yes, right. And owned by Uncle Ike.
Same guy.
Okay. It all makes sense now. I understand why the Mount Calvary Christian Center doesn't like the appearance of having a pot shop right next door, although it is separated by a parking lot, in fairness, a couple parking lots.
Mm-hmm.
But this to me just indicates how we still, for reasons that I don't really understand, put marijuana in a different category, because you have a bar right there and no one's mad about the bar.
And by the way, a Bible in which Jesus drinks wine. City Council Member Bruce Harrell called this. I said, what about this sanctified church? What is unsanctified about marijuana?
Well, it's the devil's cabbage, as you know.
Oh, okay.
There's also a liquor store in the neighborhood. This neighborhood has absolutely everything. But what the sort of second guessing revolves around, as you probably know, is the 1,000-foot rule, which came from federal sentencing rules and tobacco laws, and really doesn't mention churches. It mentions just about every other kid-related thing, like parks and arcades and community centers and transit centers, but it does not mention churches. And so it's sort of curious that this comes up now, because the city went through a very long zoning process, basically adopting the rules that were written into the state marijuana initiative 502. And so this just didn't come up before, so that sort of explains some of the
really no religious organizations lobbied the city to keep a distance between pot stores and churches.
Well, they may have, but the zoning rules do not reflect that.
Yeah.
And there may have been some Unitarian churches that requested a pot shop as close as possible. You never know. Pretty loosey-goosey.
That sounds
over there.
pretty
well,
knowing.
How about this, though? Church leaders say that they didn't know this new store going in was going to be a pot store. If that is true, Knute, was that unethical of the owner to not consult the neighbors?
No, I don't. Well, I mean, people in Seattle are surprised all the time about what gets built next door.
Yeah.
What happened to MUP boards that announce what's going in?
Well, they don't always say what the business is. I mean, they can describe, you know, a retail shop of a certain amount of square feet or something. So, I mean, it seems like it might be something they would have picked up on the grapevine. But on the other hand, often things aren't real until they're real.
Yeah.
This is exactly like gay marriage. This is exactly like the decriminalization of marijuana. This is a thing that we have to put in place, and there will be a certain number of people that are a little nervous, a little leery, and then a year or two will go by without incident, and then we will all be less hung up on it. I think this is just part of the process. I mean, had the church not, you know, found out eventually, I think it would have been a long time before they noticed any kind of, you know, deleterious behavior going on related to this. This is like the microbrew of marijuana. Like, you wouldn't be worried if somebody put in a microbrew pub near your church, because who's that going to attract? The people that are into the different kinds of beers, the presumably more respectable consumers of the product. I mean, that's what a pot shop is. The really sketchy people are going to buy the pot on 23rd and Union at the Chevron station that's across the street, or whatever that gas station is.
Well, as you know, there's a pot shortage in Washington due to some things that happened earlier. And so mostly what you have outside these shops at the beginning here, while the shortage is still underway, is a line of people waiting for the whatever hours that shop can manage, because they don't have enough supply to be open endlessly. The first pot shop has a flag waving when the pot's in.
Well, yeah, but these are the people who are not good stoners, because otherwise they would have somewhere else to get pot from.
Yeah.
So the people waiting in line, like they're at a Mervyn's, open. Those are the neophiles.
According to the city's rules, pot stores could also be next door to drug treatment centers. Do you think that would be allowed to happen because it's in the city doesn't exclude it?
It seems to have mostly to do with the amount of time that children are present at some place. That seems to be what drove the rules in the first place. That probably could happen. Yeah.
Final words?
If that happened, it would sort of up your resistance, I guess. You'd have to be very strong-willed coming out of that treatment.
There you go. Stronger than ever.
Well, I mean, I feel like I'm a broken record here, but if you're somebody who's found yourself in drug treatment, I think you know where to get drugs. I mean, that's sort of how you landed there. And the idea that you'd walk out and you'd see this very professionally, I assume anyway, professionally run place that has marijuana behind a lot of security measures, I don't think that's how the human brain actually works. It's how in our fear center it works, but not in real life.
I can understand why the people of the church are upset, particularly when the preaching in the pulpit is preaching against it. But they're going to have to look at it, I think, as an opportunity for getting some converts. They
right.
might be able
you
to make it
the
most
line.
Unpopular pot shop.
Well, take
you
a page
down
the
if they stake it out.
Hand out bags of Doritos with your turn or burn tract on the back of it.
Or sell their own at a lower price.
Luke Burbank from KUOW's Live Wire, PRI's Live Wire, and the TBTL Too Beautiful to Live podcast. Knute Berger and Mossback at crosscut.com. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Thanks, everybody. I'm Bill Radke. We'll talk to you next week.